Welcome back to Behind the Scams. Today we're unmasking the $263 million blueprint. I'm Nick, and with me on today's episode is my lovely wife, Sue.
Thank you, Nick. As always, super glad to be here.
And it really is a blueprint. You know, it completely redefines the anatomy of a heist. We are moving entirely out of the physical realm here, like into this digital ecosystem where the most devastating weapons are, well, essentially invisible. So Sue, I want you to put yourself in this scenario for a second. Imagine it's 2 in the morning, right? The house is completely dark, just pitch black.
Sounds a little spooky, but I get it.
The only light is coming from your phone sitting on the nightstand, and it suddenly buzzes. Then it buzzes again, and you're half asleep. You roll over, you pick it up, and you have like 14 simultaneous blazing red security alerts from the crypto platforms named Coinbase and Gemini.
Nick, it sounds like just a wall of panic. I'd be reaching over and beating you with a pillow real quick if that really happened to us.
I'd probably be under the bed already, so no problem. But these notifications are screaming that someone from an unrecognizable IP address is actively draining your life savings.
Yikes, that is some scary stuff.
It is, but soon after, your heart rate just explodes.
Oh, absolutely. No doubt about that.
But the thing is, that sheer panic you'd feel in your chest, that is not a side effect of the crime. That panic is the exact weapon they use to pull this off. Well, Sue, this is the crucial distinction to make right at the top of this deep dive. Because you know, this was August 2024, in Washington, D.C., right? Because a single victim, completely isolated in their own home, was drained of over 4,100 Bitcoin. And this happened in a matter of minutes, which is just, I mean, it's an astronomical sum of money. At the time of the theft, we're talking roughly $263 million.
Yeah, not exactly chump change.
And just to put the volatility of that asset class into perspective, by late 2025, that exact same stolen cash was worth over $384 million.
It's hard to even wrap your head around numbers like that, because usually, you know, when we talk about a heist of that magnitude, we picture the cinematic elements. You picture the bank robbery, right? You expect ski masks, tactical gear, heavy vault drills sparking in the dark. Maybe a getaway driver idling in an alleyway.
Exactly. We expect a physical, tangible threat. We understand like a crowbar or a shaped charge. But our mission today for this deep dive is to dissect how a crime of this scale happens without a single physical shot being fired. We are unpacking the internal operations of what federal investigators call the Social Engineering Enterprise, or the SE Enterprise for short.
Yeah. And this massive federal case file exposes what is essentially a highly sophisticated criminal industrial complex.
It really is. So Sue, let's get right into the cast of characters driving this complex, because they absolutely do not fit the profile you'd expect.
Not at all.
I can tell you this, Sue. These are not hardened cartel bosses with decades of underworld experience. At the top of the pyramid, you have the alleged mastermind. He's a 20-year-old Singaporean national named Malone Lam, operating under the online moniker King Greavies.
Right.
Yeah, King Greavies. But as fascinating as Lam is, I really want to pivot our focus to the linchpin of this entire operation.
That's right, Nick. This is the guy who made it real.
Exactly. The guy who actually made the digital theft viable in the physical world. So, we need to talk about 22-year-old Evan Tangeman from Newport Beach, California. Tangeman is the critical bridge here in the digital underworld.
And Nick, his role was that of a high-level bulk money launderer.
It certainly was. Tangeman was the operative who took these stolen digital ghosts, because let's be honest, that is all Bitcoin really is, right?
Yeah, just encrypted strings of code sitting on a public ledger.
Exactly, Sue. He took that code and washed it into tangible reality. It was a machine that turned a compromised wallet into multi-million dollar mansions, fleets of exotic cars, and cold, hard, untraceable fiat cash.
And Nick, isn't this exactly why we need to talk directly to you, the listener, right now?
Absolutely right, Sue. Because if you hold significant digital assets, you probably think your state-of-the-art cold storage hardware wallet keeps you insulated. You likely believe your complex, you know, randomly generated passwords and biometric two-factor authentication form this impenetrable fortress around your money. But as we tear apart this blueprint today, you're going to see how this digital cartel completely bypassed the technology.
So Nick, they didn't even try to break the AES 256 encryption.
No, not at all. They bypassed the tech entirely by hacking the human mind, which points to a terrifying evolution in the threat landscape. Because to execute a $250 million heist, the old model of some nerd in a dimly lit room is very outdated. The sheer logistics of moving that much illicit wealth, it requires a corporate structure. You need specialized skills, human resources, data management, and an executive layer.
So Nick, I am still trying to wrap my head around how that corporate structure even forms in the first place, though. I mean, you're telling me these are just gamers.
I know, it's wild. But yes, because the origin story of the syndicate is insane. They didn't meet in a maximum security prison yard. They didn't come up through traditional criminal families like the mafia or existing drug cartels.
Not even close. So, Nick, you're a retired special agent. Tell me and the listeners, just how did teenagers go from coordinating a World of Warcraft raid to compartmentalizing a multinational wire fraud ring? Like, who taught them this corporate structure?
Well, Sue, it was completely organic, which is perhaps the most disturbing part. It originated on online gaming platforms and dedicated communication servers like Discord in late 2023. Just hanging out online. Nothing like I ever witnessed during my 25 years in federal law enforcement.
I bet, Nick, you have these young men, teenagers, and early 20-somethings scattered across California, New York, Florida, and international hubs, clubs like Singapore and Dubai, right? And they initially bond over highly competitive multiplayer games.
That's right.
But the leap from gaming to federal wire fraud happens how? Riddle me that one, Batman. Because it must take a massive ethical and honestly psychological leap to cross that line.
Well, Sue, the leap happens through the gamification of the crime itself.
Wow, Nick, now you're really blowing my mind.
Well, Sue, you know I'm no gamer, but from what I do know, in competitive gaming, the ultimate goal is status, right? And you achieve that through flawless teamwork, resource management, and executing really complex strategies under pressure. So, they just applied that to fraud. Basically, when Malone Lamb relocated to Texas and became roommates with two unnamed co-conspirators, that house basically became an incubator, like a startup. They started experimenting with low-level cybercrime just to pay their rent. But because of their background, they didn't just steal, they optimized the theft. They realized that to hit the absolute biggest targets, the whale, they needed a rigid division of labor. They couldn't have one guy doing everything.
So, Nick, you're saying they built highly specialized corporate-style departments, literally applying corporate coordination to real-world financial systems.
You got it, Sue. That is exactly what this enterprise became. Let's actually walk through this crime as a service org chart. Because it functions exactly like a Fortune 500 company. First up, you have the database hackers.
So, Nick, their sole mandate within the criminal industrial complex is information acquisition.
They operate in complete isolation from the rest of the crime.
Yeah, I see that now.
They never speak to victims, and they never even touch the stolen funds. Their job is to either actively breach the back-end servers of cryptocurrency exchanges to steal user databases, or to scour the dark web to buy previously leaked credentials. They just purchase massive caches of data. They are essentially the raw material extractors for the cartel.
So they are mining the data, but raw data is just noise, right? I mean, a list of a million email addresses is totally useless if 99% of those people have zero crypto, right? It's just garbage data at that point. So Nick, you're saying that the raw data gets handed off to the next department, the organizers and target identifiers.
Yep. Think of the identifiers as the data analytics department of the cartel. They take these massive dumps of stolen information, which include emails, user identifiers, phone numbers, and maybe some partial details about virtual currency holdings, and they cross-reference it. They sift through the noise using automated scripts to determine the verified net worth of potential victims. They are qualifying the leads.
Okay, got it. But how exactly are they doing that cross-referencing? Are they just like guessing that a certain email address belongs to someone with money?
Oh no, it is much more methodical than that. They use techniques like credential stuffing.
Okay, what is that?
So if they have a leaked password from, say, a random gaming forum from 5 years ago, they will use automated bots to test that exact email and password combination across dozens of cryptocurrency exchanges.
Oh, wow. Because people reuse passwords.
Exactly. And I must admit, I may be guilty of that myself. But after digging through cases like this, I totally stopped doing it.
Good job. Because if they get a hit, they don't steal the money, right? Then wait, really? Why not?
Because Sue, it might just be a couple of bucks. They just log the balance. They are building a proprietary database of confirmed high net worth targets.
That is deeply unsettling. They're checking your balances and setting the table before you even know you are in the crosshairs.
They tease it up for the frontline soldiers, the callers. The callers are the social engineers. This is where the psychological warfare begins. They take those highly qualified leads from the identifiers and they execute the attack. They are the ones picking up the phone, cold calling the victims, and spinning these incredibly elaborate high-pressure narratives.
To force the victim into making a critical error, right, Nick?
Right again, Sue. And, once the callers successfully drain the wallet, the baton passes to the financial arm. Enter the money launderers, which is where our guy Evan operates. The launderers are tasked with asset dissipation and disguise, because digital currency on a public ledger is highly traceable.
It's basically a public receipt, right?
That's right. Their job is to take the stolen virtual currency, run it through complex digital labyrinths to break the chain of custody and ultimately convert it into usable physical fiat currency or luxury goods without triggering anti-money laundering tripwires.
Well, that ties in with exactly what you used to do as a special agent, right? Tracing money and putting together money laundering cases.
It is, but much more technically advanced than with whatever I used to investigate back in the day. Technology is advancing so quick. It is as if that digital ecosystem isn't terrifying enough. There is a completely physical enforcement arm to this cartel, the residential burglars.
Which is just a massive escalation. We are going to explore that terrifying escalation fully in part two. But just knowing they had a literal home invasion department on the payroll shows how far beyond a simple phishing scam this really was.
It is the crime as a service model operating at absolute peak efficiency. The reason the structure is so dangerous is its resilience.
Right, because of the compartments.
Exactly. By strictly compartmentalizing tasks, the enterprise becomes incredibly robust against law enforcement. If a caller makes a mistake and gets arrested, the database hackers remain completely anonymous and safe.
They don't even know who each other are, right?
Right. And if a money launderer like Tangerman gets compromised, the target identifiers simply route the next batch of stolen funds to a different exchanger on the network. It is scalable, modular crime.
They literally built transnational R&D, sales, and finance departments. But here's the friction point for me. If this is such a massive data-driven machine, the execution must be flawless, right? They aren't just blasting out a million generic emails, hoping somebody's grandparent clicks a bad link. How do they weaponize that raw data into a surgical strike?
Good question, Sue, because that brings us to the hit list. To understand the precision of these attacks, we really must look at the specific assets controlled by those target identifiers. Court documents reveal that at the height of the operation, Malone Lamb shared a curated collection of approximately 40 distinct stolen cryptocurrency-related databases within his inner circle.
40 entire databases just sitting on their private servers, ready to be queried.
You got it. The sheer volume of compromised information is staggering, and they were highly strategic about how they used it. They did not cast a wide net.
So, no generic phishing emails?
None. Internal communications show that members of the SE Enterprise would routinely run specific email addresses through their collated databases for one distinct purpose: to verify if a potential target was worth their time to attack. And in one of the most chilling details from the superseding indictment, there is a specific communication where a member of the Enterprise requested a fresh target list.
Yeah, I remember reading about this in the indictment.
Yes, as you may recall, another co-conspirator replied by sending him a specific spreadsheet. This document contained the emails, phone numbers, and identifiers for over 1,000 pre-verified, incredibly wealthy targets. All neatly organized, and the file was menacingly titled, and I quote, "Good Ass Yahoos to Run." I want to pause on the implication of that file name because it reveals exactly how they viewed their victims.
Sounds like it was just totally dehumanizing.
Exactly. To the SE Enterprise, these weren't people with families and lives. They were just Yahoos, marks, targets, easily manipulated variables in a game. If you are listening to this right now and you hold more than a couple of $1,000s in digital assets, I really want you to internalize this reality. It's important. Your name, your email, your phone number, and your approximate balances are highly likely sitting on a spreadsheet exactly like that right now on a server you can't see. You are on a list. The heavy lifting of the reconnaissance is already done. You are just waiting for a caller to pull your profile and initiate an attack. That is the grim reality of the modern data economy. The vulnerability isn't necessarily your password anymore. The vulnerability is your exposure. So, we know the corporate structure. We know they have this pre-verified hit list of wealthy targets ready to go. Now, we must examine the actual execution of the blueprint, right? How it actually plays out. So, Sue, let's dive into the mechanics of the DC heist. Focus on August 18th, 2024. How do you convince someone to willingly hand over 4,100 in Bitcoin?
You can't just ask for it, right, Nick?
No, you don't just ask for it. You make them genuinely believe you are the only one who can save it.
Right, a little psychology.
This is where we break down their psychological vishing tactics. Vishing being the industry term for voice phishing. But this isn't a robotic voice telling you your car warranty is expired. This is an advanced, multi-stage psychological operation. Step one of the blueprint is entirely about manufacturing a crisis. They need to hijack your nervous system before they hijack your computer, and they do that through prompt bombing or notification fatigue. The Enterprise used previously acquired unauthorized access tokens to trigger a flood of fake push notifications to the victim's devices.
Well, imagine that scenario we painted earlier. Your phone is literally vibrating off the table with security alerts that look completely authentic because they are designed to mimic the exact UI of a legitimate security warning from your exchange. The notifications suggest your account is actively being breached from a foreign location. And Nick, physiologically, your brain is betraying you in that exact moment. you're basically experiencing a mental hijack.
That's right, Sue. They call that mental hijacking, amygdala, which is the fear center of the brain. It completely overrides the prefrontal cortex, which handles logic and critical thinking. You are flooded with adrenaline, thinking about the evaporation of your life savings. And right at the apex of that panic, usually within seconds, step two occurs. The phone rings, the support call. For the DC heist, Malone Lamb, along with another co-conspirators, were the callers. And look, we have to give them credit where it is due. As much as it pains us, they were absolute professionals at this specific con. They flawlessly impersonated elite security staff.
So, Nick, depending on the specific target's portfolio, they would dynamically pretend to be from the fraud departments of Gemini, Coinbase, Google, or Yahoo.
Exactly. They adapt on the fly. I've actually listened to recordings of similar scams. The scary part is they don't sound like criminals.
How do they sound?
They sound profoundly bored. They have the corporate jargon down perfectly. They use terms like anomalous IP routing and unauthorized blockchain broadcast.
Wow, just speaking calmly to contrast with your panic.
Exactly. They tell the victim, "Sir, we are seeing the unauthorized access attempts on our end. We have frozen the outward flow for the next 3 minutes, and we are here to help you secure your funds before the hackers bypass the secondary firewall."
That is just brilliant manipulation. They manufacture a burning building and then calmly offer you the only fire escape.
And that leads directly to step three, the trap. They have established themselves as the authoritative saviors in a moment of extreme cognitive load. Now they instruct the victim to download a remote desktop connection program to, quote, diagnose the breach. I want to dig into the mechanism of this because this is where the tech gets incredibly devious. They aren't sending a malicious virus attached to an email. They are asking the victim to download legitimate software like TeamViewer. Why use those programs? Why not just steal the password? Because stealing a password triggers security protocols. If a hacker logs in from a new IP address in Dubai, the exchange will flag it. They'll block the transaction and demand two-factor authentication. But TeamViewer is a completely legitimate remote IT tool used by millions of corporations worldwide. I've used them for legitimate purposes numerous times. But if the victim installs any desk and grants the caller access, the caller is now controlling the victim's actual computer from the victim's actual IP address using the victim's actual hardware. It is what cybersecurity analysts call a living off the land attack. You are using the system's native trusted tools against itself. It completely blindsides antivirus software and zero-trust security architecture too, because as far as the computer knows, it's just the authorized user doing normal tasks. The total bypass is achieved. The attackers now have complete control over the victim's machine. They don't need to guess passwords.
Basically, Nick, you're saying they can literally open the victim's password manager.
Yes, but more importantly, they can access the victim's private keys and seed phrases. And for anyone who might not be deep into crypto architecture, we need to explain why accessing a seed phrase is the ultimate kill shot. It really is game over. A seed phrase is typically a string of 12 to 24 random words. It is essentially the master cryptographic key to your entire digital existence. If you lose your hardware wallet, you can buy a new one, type in those 12 words, and your funds are fully restored. It's the ultimate backup, and it is exactly what the SC Enterprise was after. The moment they have remote access, they locate where the victim has stored that seed phrase, which people usually store poorly. Whether it's in a text file on the desktop, a note-taking app, or an unencrypted photo. Once they possess those 12 words, the victim's hardware wallet is irrelevant.
So, what do they do then?
Well, the callers recreate the wallet on their own machines in a matter of seconds, sign a transaction, and drain every single thing to their own addresses. 4,100 Bitcoin gone in a flash, and the victim just sits there watching their screen, realizing that the support agent they are talking to is the very person robbing them.
Yikes, Nick, that is brutal.
It is beyond brutal. But the 21-second rule is essentially this window of maximum panic where the victim's logic is suspended. In the heat of that 21-second panic window, with your phone exploding with alerts and a calm voice offering salvation, it is incredibly difficult to resist following their instructions. It is a devastating exploitation of human psychology. And you know, internal communications reveal how little the SE Enterprise respected the people they were destroying.
Oh yeah, the text.
Yep, Sue. The indictment includes a text exchange from September 9th, where a co-conspirator is bragging to the group about a different successful heist. He texts Malone, "Lamb 100%, basically, a dumb shit." And Lamb replies, "Bro Connor, we have the most dabs, meaning databases, in this world, in this community, bro."
Yeah, they literally refer to the victims whose lives they are ruining as dumb assholes. It is just a sociopathic detachment.
But let's look at the aftermath of the DC heist. The 4,100 Bitcoin is successfully stolen and sitting in an address controlled by the cartel. But here is the massive logistical nightmare for the SE Enterprise.
Well, Nick, you must tell us all what that is. Because from our standpoint, things look profitable for them up to this point.
Exactly right. Things are very profitable for them. But $250 million in digital currency on a transparent public ledger is completely useless if you cannot spend it in the real world. That is the fundamental bottleneck of modern cybercrime. You cannot walk into a luxury real estate office in Miami and hand them a thumb drive with highly traced stolen Bitcoin and say, "Let's make a deal."
Sort of like, "Here's a USB stick. I'll take that mansion in South Beach."
Good analogy, because it doesn't work that way in the real world. The moment the virtual crime touches the physical banking system, it becomes vulnerable to the full weight of federal financial surveillance. Which brings us to the most critical phase of the operation, the cleanup. This is where Evan Tangeman steps out of the shadows and becomes the most vital piece on the chessboard.
Yeah, he's the key.
That's right, Sue. He is working closely with an older mentor figure in the group, a 45-year-old from Irvine who went by the alias The Accountant. Tangeman and him were the architects of the cartel's money machine. Their sole directive was to build a bridge between the blockchain and the physical economy, which is no small feat. This required both digital obfuscation and physical laundering. So let's start by dissecting the digital side to exhaust the blockchain analysts at the FBI and the Secret Service. Tangeman utilized a technique called peel chains.
Oh, Nick, I was reading about peel chains in the source material for this episode, and the initial analogy that came to mind was like a Russian nesting doll made of illicit money.
It really does, because a nesting doll usually implies one whole thing hidden entirely inside another. A peel chain is much more aggressive and fragmented than that. It is less like a nesting doll and more like a massive glacier caving into the ocean. With that, Sue, I think this is a good point to end this episode. We can definitely pick up more on this massive operation in our next episode.
Good idea, Nick, because we have already covered a lot of ground. And based on all our massive amount of source material on this federal case, there is so much more to cover. So for now, this is Sue saying bye for now, and thanks for listening to Behind the Scams.
And this is Nick. Stay tuned for our next episode in this series. It should be coming here soon, and you won't want to miss it. Thanks for listening.